Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this first hour of the program, we'll be spending some time talking about the way that media represent motherhood and how things changed, well, over the last couple of decades. Our guest for the program is Susan Douglas. She's professor of communication at University of Michigan. She's visiting the campus to talk about some of her work. And she's particularly interested, broadly speaking, in images of women in media. She's the author of a book titled Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media. And she's working on a book that will be coming out sometime in the next couple of years, looking at this particular issue. That is, broadly speaking, how media represents mothers, how it appeals to mothers, both in terms of programming and also advertising, and how it is that images of motherhood in media shape the way we think about what it is to be a good mom. And she argues that there, within the last about 20 years, two kinds of moms have predominated. One is the celebrity mom. The other is the welfare mom. One that we celebrate, one that we condemn. And interesting things follow from that. We'll talk a little bit about that this morning, and I'll give you a chance to hear from her and also talk with her as well. The number, if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, and anybody's welcome to do that, 333-9455. That's where Champaign-Urbana. Also, we do have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call for you, anywhere you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, the number is 800-222-9455. All we ask of callers is people just try to keep their comments brief so we can get in as many different folks as possible. But anyone is welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things that you point to is the fact that maybe in the early 80s, rather suddenly and dramatically, the media became obsessed with motherhood. Why? Why then, do you think?
Well, it's a good question, and I don't completely have the answer to it, but I think one of the things that we see is in the aftermath of the rise of the women's movement, which urged women to be more emotionally and economically independent and not rely solely on their husbands for, you know, their financial well-being, as well as their entire emotional sustenance, and an economy that soured very deeply in the 1970s, meaning that women in increasing numbers had to work. You had an explosion in the number of mothers with small children entering the workforce, and actually the biggest increase when you break it up into five-year periods is between 75 and 80. And so you have increasing numbers of mothers, not only of kids under six, but now kids under one, entering the workforce. And this produces a variety of dislocations, as you can imagine. One of them is that by the late 70s, there were 6 million kids who needed daycare slots, and there were only 1 million slots available. So here are millions of mothers struggling to try to figure out how to care for their children and care for them well while they're working. There's no maternity leave. There's no paternity leave. There's nothing yet called flex time. So there's an enormous amount of anxiety about the shift that is produced in families' lives because of the economy and because of feminism, and a society that hasn't caught up with that yet. And so there are a lot of concerns about what's going to happen to the children. You know, in our culture, and I'm sure this is not distinct to our culture, we see children as future citizens. And so we see children as embodying the future destiny of the country. And so we invest a lot of hopes and also anxieties in those children. So if we fear that they're not being cared for well, if they're not being, you know, loved and nurtured and fed good food and all the rest, it's not only an anxiety about the kids. It's also an anxiety about what the future country will be like when those kids grow up. So all of these very legitimate cultural and economic fears blow up, I think, in the early 1980s when society has not yet caught up with this major revolution in family life.
Mm-hmm. Well, something that certainly did happen at this time is we saw a rise in celebrity journalism. That is to say, journalism focused on the lives of celebrities, what they did, where they went, what they wore, the houses that they live in, every possible aspect of their lives. And as part of that, we saw celebrity moms, actresses, pop culture people, entertainers of various kinds, singers, what have you, profiled in this way, moms and their babies. And you've taken a look at this, and once you start looking at it, you start seeing it's kind of the same sort of deal in a sense. They're beautiful. They're happy. Their babies are beautiful and happy. Everything about their life is perfect. Doesn't hurt that they have money so they can live in the way that they would like. Tons and tons of these things broadly across mass media. There was just an explosion in these kind of pieces. Why, you know, you can say, well, partly it was just the beginning of our obsession with celebrity. But why particularly celebrity moms?
Well, you know, I don't want to suggest that actresses and, you know, famous women haven't used their children, you know, throughout the last century, right, to promote their image. And, you know, the Hollywood studios certainly did that with, we now know famously, Joan Crawford and others. But we really do begin to see a major change in the representation of celebrities and the rise of this new cultural icon, the celebrity mom, in the 1980s. And I got started on this because, you know, I had this baby. You know, there I am, you know, 7:30 in the morning, you know, at the supermarket, the kids screaming. I'm trying to get out of the checkout line. And there are all these magazine covers with, you know, Kathy Lee Gifford and all of these other stars beaming at me serenely and happily while I'm there just struggling, you know, to get through the day. And it's this onslaught kind of struck me. And so it struck me as new. So I wanted to see if it was, in fact, relatively recent. So I went back and looked at all of the magazine covers for the major women's magazines, Good Housekeeping, Ladies Home Journal, Red Book, and so forth, beginning in the 70s and up through the 90s. And what I found is that in the mid and late 1970s, there were hardly any celebrity moms on the covers of these magazines. There were celebrities, but they were talking about their careers or maybe their marriage. Then in 1981, you start to see a change. And I mean, in the 70s, there might be one cover a whole year of all of these four magazines that featured a celebrity mom. By the mid to late 1980s, 20 to 25% of the covers were celebrity moms posed with their babies. Everybody's beaming out happily at you. So the question is, why do we see this explosion? And of course, you're absolutely right. We are so surrounded now by celebrity culture. I mean, God, you know, Entertainment Tonight, Us, you know, The Star, The Inquirer, People, that we forget that this onslaught is relatively recent. And again, we've always been a culture ever since, you know, sort of mass entertainment arose that loved celebrities. And but there was a kind of major escalation of celebrity journalism that began in the late 1970s and 1980s with all of these publications and with celebrity journalism on television. And the celebrity mom became a very important icon within that. Now, why did we see her? Well, first of all, she sold magazines. It turns out that women like, you know, opening a magazine cover that shows Meg Ryan, you know, and how does she raise her child? You know, they're beautiful, they're rich, they have charisma. We want to read about them. But beyond that, a very interesting change also happened in the mid 1980s, which is prior to that, the women's magazines had, of course, been filled with male experts, Dr. Spock et al., giving women advice. And of course, Spock famously had told women that they shouldn't work outside of the home. If they did, their kids were going to suffer permanent damage. Well, after the women's movement, you know, Dr. Spock kind of fell out of favor, both because his advice had been sexist, but also Dr. Spock had never been a working mother. Now, celebrity moms had, and often, despite the fact that they make a lot of money and have lots of personal assistance and everything, their schedules can be very difficult, often more difficult than, you know, your, you know, regular working mom. Joan London had to get up at 4 a.m. to go, you know, do her morning show. The celebrities have to go on location for 2-3 months at a time. And so they were working mothers. Their jobs were often very demanding, yet they still had children. And these articles would sort of say how they did it. And for women whose mothers may have never done this, who didn't have many real-life mentors, this is the first real generation of women who, in such large numbers, are working outside the home with very little children, the celebrity mother becomes a kind of role model. And remember that in the 1980s, you know, in the sort of the wake of the women's movement, we have the explosion of role models, right? Mm-hmm. And so they become role models, and so they work very well because they sell magazines. They've done what many women are struggling to do. And also, I would say that in the 1980s, with the celebration of conspicuous consumption that emerged, you know, during the Reagan administration, they also embodied a kind of, you know, materialism and conspicuous consumption that was very glamorous, and yet they were also good mothers. So they fused a lot of elements in the culture at that time.
I should probably introduce again our guest for anyone who has just tuned in. We're talking with Susan Douglas from the Department of Communication Studies at University of Michigan. She's interested in a lot of things, particularly how mass media shape the way we think about gender, what it is to be male, what it is to be female, man and woman. She's written a book titled Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media, and is working on one that deals with images of motherhood in media. Questions? Again, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think it's really interesting that on the one hand, if you look at these kinds of profiles of celebrity moms, you have to know in your heart of hearts that if it seems like they have a great life and everything is perfect, well, first of all, you know, well, of course, nobody's life is perfect. But you have to tell yourself somewhere that, well, maybe the reason they have such a great life and things seem to be going so well is they got a lot of dough. And yeah, sure, they got a beautiful house. They can afford that. They probably have nannies and assistants and all sorts of people to help them out. You know, you look at some of them in their houses, and you have to think to yourself, this woman does not clean her own house. So on the one hand, you can look at this in a very rational way. And yet on the other hand, what you're arguing is that women are also looking at that and perhaps saying to themselves, if my life's not like that, then there must be something wrong with me. So, I mean, how is it that at the same time we could think both of those things? You can know rationally. Like, money goes a long way to making for a smooth life. And on the other hand, making an unreasonable comparison and putting that on yourself and saying, well, gosh, if my house doesn't look like that, then that somehow must be my fault.
Well, you know, throughout my work, one of the things I've really emphasized is that women identify with contradiction itself, and that, you know, when we are consuming television shows, movies, magazines, whatever, I think for many women, we inhabit several personas at the same time while we're reading. And this may be true for men as well, but I think it may be somewhat more true for women, although I'm not sure about that. Because women have been socialized to empathize and identify with multiple positions at the same time, and we're assaulted by so many different possible selves through the mass media that we kind of learn to shift between them. So when a woman is reading a magazine like this, it's not that she has one uniform reaction, as you rightly point out. She is at the same time, you know, reading about, you know, Kirstie Alley's, you know, main retreat, which has, you know, 15 bedrooms and, you know, 19 personal assistants and all the rest. And on the one hand, not all women, but many women are saying, excuse me, you know, I'd be, you know, glowing too if, you know, I didn't have to get up at 6 a.m. with my baby and do this and that and, you know, had the cook making me, you know, healthy, fat-free lunches and all the rest. And at the same time, at the very same time that a woman may be saying that and talking back to the magazine article or the movie, other highly normative messages nonetheless burrow in about what makes a good mother. And the reason I'm concerned about celebrity mom profiles, I mean, most people could say, oh, God, celebrity mom profiles, what dreck, how banal, you know, can't you find something reasonable to study? But I actually think they've been quite pernicious, and for several reasons. I think they utterly, and it's a very ossified genre, the celebrity mom profile. They're almost all the same. You just sort of plug in a different actress and, you know, different kids. But they convey the same message over and over again. They very much over-idealize and over-romanticize motherhood. They lie about how hard it is, emotionally, physically, financially. They lie about the ambivalence that many millions of mothers feel about being mothers at the very same time that we, of course, adore our children. And so I think they really can corrode a woman's self-esteem. And I think some of this has to do with the way the articles are structured, so that you can simultaneously identify with these women but envy them but also hate them, right? But I think it's also the way women consume the mass media, that we simultaneously can reject stuff but acquiesce to it at exactly the same moment.
Mm-hmm. Something else that also I think is equally interesting because of its complexity is the way that these things are connected to feminist values, and in the way that, in some sense, the way that they also go head to head with them. Because the feminist movement, one of the things the feminist movement said was, it's all right for a woman to want to be more than wife and mother. It's okay for a woman to want to have a career. Some people say, feminist movement said, there's something wrong with being a wife and mother, and I don't think that that's correct. But in any case, feminists said, hey, career's okay. So here we have women who have careers. They are important people in their own right, not because they're somebody's wife, but because they are who they are. And so one, if you were a feminist, I guess you'd want to say, hey, you know, good for you. That's what we were fighting for. Though on the other hand, they are, it seems to be, embracing a much more traditional idea of motherhood when they say things like, having this baby was the ultimate fulfillment of my life. It was like the peak experience, you know. And as sometimes in these profiles, the women actually say things like, you know, when the baby starts crying at 3 o'clock in the morning, I just leap out of bed with a smile on my face to go and find out what's the matter. So here are these two things. On the one hand, feminists say, hey, great. A working woman, working mother, career woman, important person in their own right. And then this, what they would say was a problematic notion that says having a baby is the ultimate purpose for a woman to exist. How, and maybe the thing is what, you know, we really wanted the one set of ideas and somehow couldn't lose hold of the other set of ideas. So that's why we have these things that are in some sense contradictory. We're trying to do them both.
Well, the media have always been filled with mixed messages for women, and I think that has been especially true since the 1960s. And, you know, it would be very easy for me as a feminist to just, you know, trash the media for their series of sexist images, but it's not that simple. There has been a war on the mass media for at least 40 years, longer actually, between feminism and anti-feminism at exactly the same time. And so what we see in television programs, magazines, etc., is a kind of odd fusion, as you point out, between kind of pre-feminist or even anti-feminist notions and feminist notions that get cobbled together in this odd brew, right, where certain elements of feminism have gotten folded into a kind of mainstream now. Most women in this country do not want to go back to 1954, right? They just don't. Or they can't, right? And I think a lot of feminist tenets have gotten folded into a mainstream, but others still have not. And I think when you see a kind of a reconfiguration around motherhood in the mid-1980s, let's also not forget that in addition to enormous anxieties about what's going to happen to the family, motherhood, children during this period, this is happening within a new conservative sort of political framework in the country. And within that political framework, there is an effort to dismantle a variety of programs to help women and children, especially poor women and children. There's an anti-feminist backlash, as Susan Faludi and others have written about. And so that also, frames these evolving notions of what good motherhood should be. So you do get this very odd fusion. And women as readers and mothers, are constantly sort of negotiating these things. I mean, for example, when I had my baby, you're looking at these advice books, your kid's in the bedroom screaming, okay? One advice book says, this is Spock actually, shut the door, stick a towel, on the bottoms, and let the kid cry, and eventually he or she will go to sleep. Then you open Penelope Leach. Don't do that. It will ruin your kid for life. You go in, you pick the child up no matter what. And so through advice in books and magazines, we were being pulled in different directions, and some of those directions were more anchored to feminism, and some of those directions were more anchored towards pre-feminism.
Well, we all know that being a parent is hard work, that there'll be times when your children will drive you nuts, when it will just seem that you're going from putting out one fire to the next, when they're chaos and crisis, and you just feel like shoving them out the front door and saying, right when you get work. On the other hand, I think people, if you get them in the right mood, men and women now, will say to you, you know, having this child was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. That it is a wonderful experience, that it can be an amazing thing as you watch them grow up and discover the world and learn things. And it really is great. Given that, you know, we have both of these realities, but given the fact that men and women would say, you know, this really was a cool thing, I'm really happy about being a parent, what's wrong with the angle of the celebrity mom profile that just gushes about what a wonderful thing having a baby is? I mean, why is that really problematic?
Well, I've got a daughter, and I think she's the greatest thing in the world. And it has been very hard being a mother, and it's also, watching her grow up has been an indescribable experience and joy. So, of course, we all say mushy things about our kids, and we mean them, right? My concern with the celebrity mom profiles, there are several. One is they up the ante about what it means to be a good mother, what you have to do to be a good mother. And this intersects with, kind of the Martha Stewartization of America, right, where not only are we supposed to, like, you know, try to do our jobs reasonably, you know, maintain our relationships with our significant others and be good mothers, but now, you know, we're supposed to, you know, make gingerbread castles that look like Versailles and, you know, have this beautiful sun-drenched homes and all the rest. And so what has been expected of mothers to do has increased enormously. And actually, if you look at other media in relation to, in addition to the celebrity mom profile, advertising, for example, you know, if you look at advertising in the 1970s for, you know, directed at mothers, it's like Tide detergent. Okay, your kids' clothes are dirty. Here, use Tide. It's better. You know, it'll get them whiter. By the 80s and 90s, you start seeing ads that ask mothers to anticipate their child's mind frame ahead of time, so that the child won't be bored, so that the child won't miss out on an educational opportunity. And all these kinds of ads for, bringing Legos in the car so the kid will never have a bored moment, or for these TV dinners that had little puzzles and learning devices in them, interacted with celebrity mom profiles that talked about all of the things, the enriching educational things that they did for their children, even though they worked really hard. And if you're a mother and you're reading that, you know, and you go to work at 8 a.m. and you get back at 6, and if you can zap some, you know, Prego spaghetti sauce in the microwave and get some pasta on, like, you know, you're doing good, right? They up the ante and up the guilt about what you think is required to be a good mother. So that's one of my concerns about these. Because what you find when you poll mothers, working mothers, the first word out of their mouths is guilt. And most of them are actually doing a very good job by their kids. Mm. The other thing about these celebrity mom profiles that I think is problematic is I feel very strongly that raising our children without quoting from the hideous title of Hillary Clinton's book, you know, it Takes a Village, should be a collective communal activity. We as a culture and a nation and a society should be thinking collectively about raising the next generation of kids. We should think about government policies that support mothers and children and fathers, too, that support families. And what the celebrity profile does is it's always about a rugged individual who needs no help. She's done it on her own. She's pulled herself up by her bootstraps. So it emphasizes a kind of individualism, a going it alone, that there's no need for any kind of support networks. And I think that's a very dangerous message, especially when you're thinking about our collective responsibility to our kids. The third thing that I find very pernicious about celebrity mom profiles, and I know a lot of parents are concerned about this, is their incessant emphasis on conspicuous consumption. And that, you know, to really be a good parent, you've got to buy, 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 buy. And I think a lot of us are feeling that we and our children are under now a kind of avalanche of marketing appeals to us and our kids that actually at times interfere with our relationships with our children and put children and parents under enormous pressure. And celebrity moms, as you were saying earlier about their lavish homes and their lavish stuff, suggest an equation between having a lot of stuff that you can give to your kids and being a good parent. So those are some of the things that I think are unfortunate about these profiles.
Yeah. We're just about at our midpoint, and I want to make sure that we look at the other side of the coin here. But I'm curious about images of fatherhood. And maybe I need to find another, somebody who specializes in that. But I'm sure that you've thought about this. And I guess I'm just curious about what was happening at the same time and whether something similar was happening with the way media was looking at fatherhood. And in fact, that in some way, if what was happening with women was we had this thing that said, at some point we said, in addition to being a mom, you can have a career. What we're saying with men was, in addition to having a career, you can be super dad. And while we still put much more emphasis on moms and what women do, something of the same sort of thing happened to men, and I can't imagine them, again, perhaps having something of the same experience and feeling that, we're now supposed to be nurturing and spending quality time with the kids, and that at the same time we have to also pay attention to what is happening with our career and making sure that we're earning money, and maybe some of the same unrealistic expectations and pressures, not as extreme for women, but are also there for men.
I think that's absolutely right. And if you look at some of the shows of the 1980s, whether it was the Cosby Show, the most perfect dad in America, right? Always understanding, talking to his kids, although not at the expense, I might note, of his work, or 30-something, right, which had these sensitive new age dads, did up the ante for what good fatherhood involved. And I think also, feminism said fathers should be involved. And I think one of the great things about that moment is actually a lot of men responded, and they responded happily. They did want to become more involved in their kids' lives. And, while women still carry the burden across this country, the primary burden for child rearing in this country, there has been a revolution in fatherhood in this country. My husband does stuff my dad never did. And I see fathers all over the place doing kinds of things for their kids that their dads didn't. And I find one of the things that has turned many men into feminists overnight is when they have a daughter, and they say, nobody's going to tell me my daughter can't have the same opportunities as a boy, right? Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. And we have seen more of an emphasis on being sensitive and caring and more involved with your children. On the flip side of that, what we also saw in the late 80s, early 90s, was also increased opprobrium heaped on fathers who didn't do their job. Remember, deadbeat dads, the effort to garnish men's wages, who were not paying child support. But I think this came down very heavily on African-American men, I will say, that a lot of the sort of media discourse about bad fathers, irresponsible fathers, was very heavily laid at the feet of African-American men as opposed to white men. But you did see increasing anxiety about fatherhood, and that even came out in Promise Keepers, a men's movement that, is not synonymous with my own interests, because part of it has to do with keeping women in their place. But there was an emphasis there on good fatherhood as well. So there has been, I would say, increasing pressure on dads. Now, having said that, there are many more media outlets just geared to mothers than there are to fathers, whether it's cable channels, magazines. I mean, there's Parents Magazine, but, it's for women. There's a magazine called Working Mother Working Mother, but I don't believe there's one, Working Dad. And a lot of these magazines address and assault women in particular ways. What are you doing wrong with discipline? How can you do? So the mode of address to women is more incessant and a sort of accusatory than what men get. And after all, I mean, we're still living in a society where I think that if it's, you know, 5 o'clock and you're still in a meeting and you're a man and you say, I'm sorry, I've got to go and pick, you know, Charlie up from daycare. Everybody thinks, oh, what a great dad, you know. But if mom says, I've got to go pick up Charlie for daycare, oh, well, you know. So I do think there are still some real double standards around parenthood. But I also think your point is very well taken.
We have a caller here. We are a little bit past the midpoint. We're talking with Susan Douglas from University of Michigan. She's interested in a lot of things, but very specifically in mass media and how that leads us to think about what it is to be man, what it is to be woman. She's the author of a book titled Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media, and is working on one that will be out maybe in a couple of years dealing with this very topic, that is images of motherhood in media. We have a couple of callers here. We have others are welcome to call. If you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here we have somebody on cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Yes, sir. I'd like to ask your guest, when the attitude toward having children out of wedlock changed so dramatically, and is someone not telling these young women about the economic facts of life when they elect to have children out of wedlock and so on? I'll hang up and listen if I may.
Okay, sure.
It's a good question, and the answer is somewhat complicated, I think. But the attitudes, I think, begin to change in the 1970s and especially in the 1980s. And they change in different communities for different reasons. I mean, obviously, there was an enormous amount of attention paid when welfare reform was at the lobbying for welfare reform was at its height in the 80s and 90s to unwed African American teenage mothers. But in fact, the rate of growth of unwed teenage mothers was much higher among white girls than it was among African American girls, and you know, there have been a variety of reasons attributed to this. You know, the hope for unconditional love, being in an economic or social situation in which you don't have enough economic information. What has not gotten nearly enough attention is the extent to which many of these teenage girls, in fact, got pregnant by older men in their mid-20s or older, was sort of seduced by these guys, and then there they were. Now, what we all remember the, famous Murphy Brown debate with Dan Quayle. But it is true that celebrities like Farrah Fawcett, Jodie Foster, and others did begin to lead the way in unwed, motherhood, either or single or not. And that also, I would say, in the late 80s and 90s, paved the way for some of that. Now, the caller is rightly expresses concern about particularly teenage girls getting pregnant when they just have no idea what they're in for. And, I think we, it's very controversial in this country, but I actually think we need to be doing a better job of sex education than we are. We can't have television shows that are constantly titillating about sex and suggesting that sex is exciting and fun and a recreational activity and, a way to sort of, make somebody like you, and then not give people realistic sex education in classrooms so they understand really what the stakes are. So obviously that's a problem. But that is a different situation, and I think it's a real problem. When young girls get pregnant when they're young and keep the baby, it is a huge economic and emotional struggle to crawl out of the hole they get into. Hmm. But on the other side, of course, what we found is that with the breakdown of marriage, we have also seen, and a variety of other factors, we have seen women in their 30s say, I haven't met Mr. Right. I want to have a child. I'm going to figure out a way to do it, adoption or whatever. And I think that's a different trend. And a lot of those mothers are very good mothers. I think it's hard. But But I think those trends have interacted with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it goes back again to showing the way that we have something of a double standard here, and in fact that we maybe have our idea of what's going on may not square up with reality, because people so much when they talk about the problem, quote unquote, the problem of unwed motherhood in the United States, the image that most often is going to come to a lot of people's minds is young minority women, when in fact when you look at where the significant rate of growth is of women who are not married having children, it's middle class, it's older middle class women who have indeed made that decision that they really want to have a child, feel that the time is running out, maybe they haven't met the person they thought's going to be the ideal partner, so they say, well, I'm going to have this baby and I'm going to worry about finding a husband some other day. And not only, I think, do we not quite recognize that, but we're still of a mindset that says, well, that's okay, but that, that you know, depending on the sort of a class issue, in one sense we're saying that's okay, and in the other sense we're saying, oh, that's a big problem.
That's right. Well, it's the same thing about work, right? You know, what happened when, you know, Clinton was pushing for ending welfare as we know it? What we had was a real condemnation of welfare mothers, because they were staying home and not working. They had to go out and work. But at the same time, there was also an ongoing subtle attack on middle class and upper middle class women who did work. Somehow they were cheating their kids. Well, you know, you can't have it both ways. Mm-hmm. And there are double standards based on class and race we would be really good to get beyond.
Let's go to Champaign. That will be, let me see, line number three. Hello.
Hi. Well, you kind of stole my thunder on the television thing, because I was noticing last night almost every show was just involved with, you know, titillating sex into windows. And you know, my daughter was in and out of the room kind of watching it, and it's kind of like, you know, it's like, I don't want to watching this. And my other problem with her that's going on is her influences in music. She knows practically every word of, you know, all the Backstreet Boys and Britney Spears and all the suggestions I make there. And I just wanted to make that comment that it seems like she's just getting bombarded at she's only in first grade, and every kid in school comes in and, you know, I got the new CD and you know, she wants to wear crop top outfits and like Britney Spears and all that stuff.
Yeah, just we're so awash in this pop culture. How do you you know, the message is the message is so loud as a parent. How do you even get an equal voice?
I think that I am a child of the 60s. I am not a prude, but like the caller, I have had enough, you know.
Yeah.
I really have. I mean, you know, when TV Guide comes into your house and every other week, you know, sex is like, you know, 4 inches high on the cover of TV Guide, right? The largest circulation magazine in the country. You think something may be amiss. And like you, my daughter is 12 now, but for years we did not have any of the networks on, you know, until 9 o'clock, because there were shows I liked, I thought were funny, right? But they were inappropriate for her. So we had Nickelodeon on when the TV set was on, because we didn't want her seeing that kind of stuff.
Watching a lot more Cartoon Network. And also, just for the sake of knowledge, my wife is out of town for the next 4 days, and I've got both my kids, and they're like, so you're babysitting. It's like, it's not babysitting, it's being a dad.
Right, right.
I get tired of hearing that, it's like, no, I'm not babysitting, I'm just doing what I have to do.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, I wanted to connect two of the ideas that were discussed in a couple of the previous calls. I'd like very much to see that the notion of raising a child be independent of whether you are a man or a woman or married. I also have a daughter, and she is also moving into that phase where she feels the biological clock is running out on her, and she has, she has not, quote, met the right guy. And she's getting to a point where she thinks, well, okay, almost anybody will do. And I think that's a terrible shame that there are lots and lots of children in the world who desperately need homes. And people should be encouraged to do it. It's a lot harder. There's no question that raising a child on your own, particularly if you have a profession, is very, very tough. But if you're financially okay and you've sort of thought it through, I think that should be an option, and it should be an option for men as well as women. And I know there isn't an awful lot of discussion about that. I'd be curious about your reaction to that.
Well, I do think we are trapped in this ridiculous, still nostalgic notion about what constitutes a real family. And there's a great book out by a woman named Stephanie Kuntz called The Way We Never Were, right, which is about the alleged nuclear family, and it's a white family, of course, mom, dad, and two kids. This family is not the norm in our country anymore, where you have a mother and a father who are married to each other and they have two children. This is, of course, one kind of a family, but there are millions of other kinds of families who do not make it onto the media radar screen. They are either marginalized as dysfunctional or troubled or weird or whatever. And in fact, in this country, there are tens of millions of women raising children by themselves. I just learned yesterday at a talk here that there are 70,000 grandparents in the United States, in Illinois, raising their grandchildren as parents. That's another kind of a family that you don't hear that much about, grandparents raising their own grandchildren for whatever reasons. There were gay and lesbian couples raising kids. There are extended families raising kids. And you're right, the most important thing is the well-being of the child. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, I would say the well-being of the child, but also the interaction, because, I think raising a child is a wonderful experience, like owning a dog is a wonderful experience, and why should you be denied it because, you're not married or you haven't found the right person? I would like to just suggest that you think in the future about writing a book called something like Alternate Families.
Well, there are actually a couple of books out. There's a woman named Judith Stacey, Stacey, who's written a couple of books about alternative families that are pretty interesting. I think there are some other books out as well about alternative families that you might find interesting.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, sure. Thanks for the call. We just are at the point here. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left, and our guest is Susan Douglas from University of Michigan. We have been talking about images of motherhood in media, something that she's very interested in and is working on a book that will explore that. And we do have another caller here, so I want to make sure we get them. This will be Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Follows in with a previous caller and what you've been saying. We went to a U of I home basketball game a couple of games ago, and in the halftime show, there was it was Dance on the Move or something like this. There were two competitive teams. One was young women who looked like they might have been junior high school. Another group was grade school and prepubescent, and they were doing routines that made me blush. I've talked about sex in front of classrooms, and I just looked at these kids doing a bump and grind and with little skimpy costumes on, and I thought to myself, what is going on here? We've got men who think that little girls are sex objects, and here we are encouraging them. I was just astounded that parents would let their kids be part of this and that there would be an organization doing this sort of thing. And nobody seemed to bat an eyelash, except for one person I knew walked by and commented about this. It just boggles my mind.
Well, I speak a lot around the country, and I will tell you that this is a major issue for parents. And you can be a conservative Republican and a liberal Democrat, and this issue unites parents across political lines. Millions of parents are very concerned about the sexualization of children, about the bombardment of sexual messages on them. And, on the one hand, I think some of us would like to be as frank with our children as possible about sex so as to maybe demystify it and help them through that tough time, which they're going to hit when they're teenagers. But on the other hand, this is a highly commodified version of sexuality. And as you say, when you see 7, 8, 9-year-old girls doing this stuff, it gives me the creeps, frankly. And I don't know sort of where this trend and where parents are going to go with this, but I do know that millions of parents are very concerned about this trend, and at the very same time, they will look, you know, to their neighbors who think this is cute. And those parents, I don't understand.
Yeah, I'm somebody who thinks that we need to give kids better and more information about sexuality, but this is perversion.
Right, this is not the way.
No. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right, thanks. We have a couple minutes left, and we've there's a whole party here that I thought we should get into. We would get into. We really haven't. And you know, that's fine. We could talk some more on another day. That is the other side of this, the welfare mom. That we've talked a lot about the celebrity mom and how we celebrate her. News media, in the way that they write about the issue of poverty and welfare reform, has spent an awful lot of time presenting with us another kind of mom that is sort of the object. If we say the one, this is the way we want to be, we say the other, no, this is bad. We have all kinds of problems because we have moms like this. And the thing that, again, here is significant is, and you've looked at, is how in media coverage of the issue of welfare and poverty, we went from a point where it was dealt with kind of as a policy issue to the point where it's dealt with as a people issue.
Right.
So before, the problem was sort of structural, it was policy, it was economics. Now it's like, well, the problem is these women.
Right.
And how that happened is a really interesting question. It's another one of those, it's hard to say, well, exactly when did that happen?
It's a tough question, and I'm working on it right now. But if you look at, say, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report in the early to mid-1970s, when there was concern about the rise in welfare rolls because the economy was going so bad, the illustrations would be charts and graphs, you know, showing the increase in welfare rolls. There would be long shots of welfare offices with lots of people in them. But it was illustrated as a kind of abstract policy problem. Fast forward to 1989, 1990, and the images used to illustrate the problem of welfare are welfare mothers, black welfare mothers. Occasionally there would be, you know, a white woman or maybe a Latina woman, but for the most part, they were African-American women. A couple of things account for this. One is the news media in the 1980s, increasingly relied on personification to tell its stories. I don't know if people remember when Reagan was president, but when there was a debate between Reagan and Congress, there'd be a picture of Reagan on one side of the screen and a picture of Tip O'Neill on the other side of the screen. And this kind of personification increased in the 1980s, and so it was a kind of media convention that allowed for this sort of representation of these mothers. But also, I will say that the rise of conservative punditry in the 1980s, in which, especially after the Fairness Doctrine went away, which stations were no longer required to air multiple or both sides of an issue, we had increasing numbers of conservative pundits who demonized single mothers and welfare mothers repeatedly, whether it was Rush Limbaugh, whether it was Fred Barnes or McLaughlin or whatever. And they were kind of pundit elites who helped set an agenda for, not by themselves, obviously, but for the news media. So there were a bunch of forces interacting, including the broader framework of obsession about motherhood. And what we saw was, instead of a war on poverty, which we had in the early 1960s, we had a war on welfare mothers.
I'm sorry that we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. We want to say, Susan Douglas, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
She's a professor of communication studies from the University of Michigan. If you'd like to read some of her writing, you can look for her book, Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media. And sometime in the next couple of years, there will be a book dealing with this topic we've been discussing, images of moms in media. So, again, thanks very much.
Thank you.